We've already talked about half of gene expression, which is transcription. The rest of the chapter is about the second part, which is translation. And translation does not directly involve DNA. By this point, DNA's job is already done, which is simply to stand for the code for how to build the messenger RNA, which is the product of transcription. Now, messenger RNA is carrying the code. That's why it's called messenger RNA, and it's time to actually build the polypeptide. One amino acid at a time. That's a polymerization process, of course, assembling those individual amino acids with peptide bonds. And that requires the help of an important molecular machine, which is an organelle, or at least I define it as an organelle, but it's not a membrane-bounded organelle. So all cells have these, including prokaryotic cells. The organelle I'm talking about is the ribosome, which is the brown part of this cartoon. We've looked at ribosomes before, and I've told you that they are two-part devices. There's a small ribosomal subunit, which is the bottom part here where the word codons is, and a large ribosomal subunit. You don't see any molecular detail. It's just brown here. But in terms of what makes it up, molecularly speaking, the stuff that makes up a ribosome is a combination of two macromolecule types. One is proteins, and the other is RNA. So this is another form of RNA. We've already talked about some kinds of RNA already in the transcription process, right? We talked about messenger RNA, of course. That's the product of transcription. What other kind of RNA was involved in transcription? At least for eukaryotic organisms.
Which was one you said earlier?
What kind of RNA, other than messenger RNA, did we already talk about?
The snRNPs?
Yes. snRNPs are small ribonucleoproteins, but a ribonucleoprotein is part protein and part RNA. So that's another kind of RNA. Here we're going to talk about a couple more kinds, one of which is the RNA that's part of this brownness. And since it's part of a ribosome, it's called ribosomal RNA, or rRNA, small rRNA. So it's involved in translation. Of course, as you can see here, and it shouldn't surprise you, messenger RNA is also going to be involved in the process of translation because it's bringing the code to the ribosome. And we've already talked about that, but that's two types of RNA. And then another type that's involved in translation is depicted by these teal-colored bent pegs, each of which is another kind of RNA called transfer RNA, or tRNA for short. Before I talk more about tRNA, let me say one more thing about ribosomal RNA, which is in this brown mix. Like I said, you don't really see it here. We've talked a lot about enzymes already, and so you already know that enzymes are proteins that act as catalysts in organisms. For a long time, we said that all biological catalysts are proteins. That turned out to be wrong. By far, most biological catalysts are proteins, and all of those proteins that act as catalysts are called enzymes properly. But then we realized that certain kinds of RNA can act as enzymes as well, including ribosomal RNA. And we don't call those enzymes, even though they're acting as catalysts, because they are not proteins. So we made up a new word called ribozymes. Ribozymes are RNAs that are acting as catalysts. And that's the important component of the ribosome. The RNA component acts as an enzyme. Okay, now back to transfer RNA, tRNA. They get their name because peptides, meaning strings of amino acids of whatever length, it's not a polypeptide technically until there's many amino acids strung together, but you have to start by hooking two together, then hooking one more, and so on. So peptides get transferred from one tRNA to another. And we'll get a better picture of that in a little bit. But that's why they're called tRNAs. Even before that happens, though, tRNAs have the important job of bringing in the next required amino acid to make the peptide that's being built one amino acid longer. So this is a stepwise process, this polymerization, this forming a polymer of RNA, of amino acids, known as a polypeptide, requires adding one more amino acid at a time. And transfer RNA brings that in. Now, functionally speaking, there are two major categories of tRNA. One of which is called uncharged tRNA. And this has nothing to do with electrical charge. A charged tRNA is called charged if it is connected to an amino acid. If it's carrying that amino acid, in other words. But you can see in the cartoon that these ones on the left, the one that's leaving the ribosome and going off on its own, is at the moment not connected to an amino acid. The purple things are amino acids. It was connected to one, but now it's not. So it's an uncharged tRNA. That's all that means. Therefore, the other major category are charged tRNAs. Any charged tRNA is directly connected to an amino acid. But notice there's two ways that this can happen. This one on the left that's coming in, one on the right that's coming in and is carrying this GLY amino acid, glycine, is a charged tRNA by definition because it's connected to an amino acid. But this one is connected to just a single amino acid. The one in the middle is connected to an amino acid, but the amino acid that it's connected to is connected to other amino acids. So, the second major category, charged tRNAs, can be subdivided into two categories. A charged tRNA that is connected to exactly one amino acid, like this glycine one, is called an aminoacyl tRNA. The aminoacyl is just an adjective form referring to a single amino acid. Now, any charged tRNA is directly connected to only one amino acid, right? This middle one is only directly connected to phenylalanine. But if the amino acid is just one of several, at least more than one, that the tRNA is carrying, then instead of it being called an aminoacyl tRNA, it's called a peptidyl tRNA, because what it's carrying is not a single amino acid, it's a peptide of some length. Okay, so they're both of those combined make up the charged tRNAs. And no tRNA is permanently any one of these categories. This uncharged tRNA that's leaving the ribosome used to be charged. And at one time it was an aminoacyl tRNA, then it was a peptidyl tRNA, and now it's an uncharged tRNA, and it's going to go back to being an aminoacyl tRNA. Those are just functional categories. But actually there are many different individual kinds of tRNAs. And that has to be true simply because there are many different individual kinds of biological amino acids, right? Since there are many biological amino acids, there are many kinds of tRNA, each of which is allowed to carry, if it's carrying anything, only one kind of amino acid. You have to have different kinds of tRNA to carry the different kinds of amino acids so that the integrity of the information is maintained. What I mean by that is so that you're ensuring that what comes in and gets added next as an amino acid is the correct amino acid according to what is being read in the messenger RNA, which is telling the ribosome, codon by codon, what the next amino acid should be. You have to be sure to build the right protein, which requires ensuring that you're adding each time only the correct kind of amino acid. So there is a pool of tRNA molecules in the cell. Any individual one at any given moment could be charged or uncharged, and if it's charged, it could be aminoacyl or peptidyl. Okay? Before I leave this, let me explain this labeling of anticodon. This is really important. A tRNA is going to be allowed into this ribosome only if that a special part of its sequence, the tRNA's sequence, called the anticodon, is a good match by complementarity rules with the current codon that's being read by the ribosome. Any other anticodon, which do exist on the other kinds of tRNA, will not match up complementarily with this codon, and therefore they will not be allowed in. That's how the cell ensures that the correct protein is being made. Because the codon, remember, from the genetic code, is specifying an amino acid. Well, only a tRNA that has the corresponding anticodon for that codon is allowed to carry the amino acid that codon specifies in the genetic code. If you looked up GGC in the genetic code, it would tell you that specifies glycine. And that's why any individual kind of tRNA is only ever allowed to carry one kind of amino acid and no other kind. Let's take a closer look in 13 at tRNA structurally. Remember, there's many kinds. This is just an example of one. So the sequence will be different, but they all basically three-dimensionally have this kind of bent shape. If you force that three-dimensional shape, though, if you flatten the molecule out onto a page, like on the top, into two dimensions, then it has what is called a clover leaf shape, like the three leaflets of a clover. Remember that RNA is typically a single-stranded nucleic acid, not double-stranded like DNA. But an RNA single strand, if it's the right sequence, can fold back on itself because of complementarity. This is all one strand, but it has bends in it and complementary regions that do hydrogen bond as though it were two strands. And that's what forms these hairpin loops that give it the cloverleaf arrangement. It's an RNA molecule, so the entire thing is a sequence of A's, U's, C's, and G's, but there's three particular nucleotides that we pay attention to much more than the rest of the sequence. And those three collectively are what was labeled in the previous one and what's labeled here as the anticodon. The anticodon is different for each different kind of tRNA. And it's called an anticodon because it is complementary to a particular codon. This one is AAG, so the codon corresponding would be what? What codon would this be allowed to meet up with? TTC, yes. Okay. That is why you need different kinds of amino acids and different kinds of tRNA, so that there's always going to be a correct match between codon and amino acid via codon directly to anticodon, and that kind of tRNA is carrying the corresponding amino acid. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, it is UUC. It's because the DNA would be TTC. But remember, it's the messenger RNA that has the codon. Yeah, sorry, I misspoke. Okay, now, just like any nucleic acid, this has a 3' end and a 5' end. But importantly, it's the 3' end of whatever tRNA you're talking about that is able to be attached to an amino acid. So that's the carrying end of the RNA, the 3' end. Now, if it's an uncharged tRNA, then it's just the 3' end, and it's not carrying anything. But if it's a charged tRNA, then the amino acid that it's directly connected to is connected at the 3' end. Okay, so the next question then, I mean, it makes sense, of course, that this kind of tRNA with its anticodon is only able to ever carry that one amino acid. Otherwise, you would mix up the protein, right? But the next question is, how does the cell make sure that that kind of tRNA will carry only one kind of amino acid? That's shown in 14. As with all processes in biochemistry, an enzyme is involved in this process. The process I'm talking about is the charging of a tRNA. That means the hooking on of an amino acid to an uncharged tRNA. And that has to be a careful process because you have to make sure that it's only the correct kind of amino acid for that tRNA that gets hooked onto it. So just as there are different kinds of tRNA, there are different versions of this enzyme working at. It's not just one master enzyme. But the family of enzymes are called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase enzymes. Now, and in the cartoon, it's the grayish thing that kind of looks like an embryo in its shape. But an aminoacyl tRNA synthetase is not aminoacyl tRNA, right? The synthetase name tells you that it's an enzyme, so it's a protein. But it's called aminoacyl tRNA synthetase because it synthesizes. To synthesize means to bring together two things. Just like ATP synthase brought together ADP and inorganic phosphate, what's being synthesized here are an uncharged tRNA and the amino acid that it's allowed to carry. In other words, aminoacyl tRNA synthetase catalyzes the charging of an uncharged tRNA with its appropriate amino acid. And that's why it has an elaborate active site, as you see here. The active site needs to be able to bond to that particular kind of amino acid, and a different kind of aminoacyl tRNA will work for a different kind of amino acid. That's why I said this is a family. But whatever amino acid this one's allowed to bind to, it can. And then the rest of the active site accepts the uncharged tRNA that's allowed to carry that particular kind of amino acid. Only the right one of each of those gets in for this particular enzyme. And that ensures that the tRNA is always going to be carrying its correct amino acid. And notice that this requires some expenditure of ATP. That shouldn't surprise you because you're synthesizing, right? You're building a bigger thing out of smaller things. Once the tRNA is charged, it's not only charged, it's more specifically an aminoacyl tRNA, right? Because it's carrying just a single amino acid. It gets released from the enzyme, and as usual, the enzyme isn't changed, so it can keep doing the same thing. So this pool of tRNAs that I'm talking about is always changing. As tRNAs drop off their amino acids to the ribosome, and then become uncharged and get removed from the ribosome, like in that first picture I showed you today, they are just part of the uncharged pool that then need to find their appropriate kind of enzyme to get recharged. So there's many, many copies of each of the several kinds of charged amino acyl tRNAs available at any given moment, basically waiting for their particular codon to come up at a ribosome so that they can drop off their amino acid. Okay, that's what's happening in the cytosol. Now let's take a look, closer look at the ribosome itself, slide 15. And the top is the, of these three pictures, it's the most realistic in terms of the actual shape, but it doesn't really show you much. It's easier to look at the fully cartoon version in the middle, which is a lie, by the way. Remember, you wouldn't have a ribosome have both of its subunits together if it's not being used, if there's not already mRNA there as well. So just for simplicity, they didn't draw the mRNA, but until the mRNA is there, the two subunits would never come together. They just exist as a pool of large subunits that are all identical, pool of small subunits that are all identical, and so they're modular. Doesn't matter which large and which small you use. Anyway, the large subunit, as you see, has three slots in it, which are labeled. We're used to reading left to right in English, but in terms of the order in which they're used, it's right to left in this picture. So A first, then P, then E. The A slot gets its name because it's the amino acyl tRNA binding site, meaning that's the slot into which an amino acyl tRNA, which by definition is carrying just one amino acid, is allowed into that slot, bringing just that particular amino acid that corresponds to the codon that's being read on the mRNA at that A slot, which is not shown here. All right, but that's what the A stands for. The peptidyl tRNA binding site is the P slot in the middle. So the tRNA that's occupying that, and you can see that on the bottom here. Well, actually, the mRNA is shown on the bottom. I should have been showing you the bottom. But notice that the tRNA that's in the P slot is a peptidyl tRNA because it's carrying a peptide of some length. In other words, some amino acids have already been assembled into a peptide, and that's what this particular tRNA at the moment is carrying. So that defines this tRNA as a peptidyl tRNA, and it's in the P slot. But it's going to then transfer this entire peptide to the amino acid that's being carried by the amino acyl tRNA in the A slot. And that's going to make the peptide now one amino acid longer. It's going to be 5 long next, right? And then 6 and so on. The E slot on the left, you can think as standing for exit or eject. It's the slot that is going to be occupied temporarily by a now uncharged tRNA after it's gotten rid of its peptide that it transferred to the next tRNA. You can see that here on the bottom. It's an uncharged tRNA and it gets ejected or it exits from the E slot and then needs to go back and find the correct kind of amino acyl tRNA synthetase enzyme to recharge it with the same kind of amino acid again. All right, so that happens over and over, reading a codon at a time on the mRNA, which specifies which kind of amino acid can come in next, but until you hit a stop codon, the peptide will get longer and longer until it's done, until it's as long as it needs to be. So let's look at the process of translation 16. First, though, think back to transcription, which is what we talked about last time. Transcription as a process, remember, happened in three phases. What were the name of those phases? Keeping in mind that you won't have any notes on test day. right? Initiation, elongation, termination. Well, what happens during those is totally different from what happens in translation, but translation has exactly the same named three phases. So there's initiation, elongation, and termination of translation also. Don't be confused by the fact that the names are the same, even though different things are happening. What we're looking at in 16 is initiation of translation. And here we can see why I was saying it was a lie before about the ribosomes. What has to happen before you complete a ribosome is that the messenger RNA has to bind to just a small ribosomal subunit by itself. And also what comes along is a tRNA that is carrying methionine. Now, why is it always one that's carrying methionine? Well, yes, but more specifically, because the start codon in the genetic code, which is AUG, is the codon that also specifies methionine as the amino acid. So methionine, whether it needs to be in the final product or not, is always the first amino acid put down. Okay? And there is no large ribosomal subunit yet. But notice that there is an mRNA binding site on this small ribosomal subunit. That is what allows it to actually bind to the mRNA, as the name describes. But when it does that, it perfectly centers this start codon at the position that will be the P slot, not the A slot, the P slot, when the large subunit comes along. And by the way, notice that this is an important part of that untranslated region that we talked about last time. The translated region is only made up of codons. So this is nucleotide sequence in the mRNA, but it's not codons because it's not going to be specifying an amino acid. It's there to bind it correctly. Until you get the start codon, you don't have any amino acids being specified. Then you have so many codons, however long, until you hit one of the three stop codons. That's how the ribosome is going to know how many amino acids to add. All right, so these three things come together, and notice the correspondence between AUG, the start codon, and UAC, the anticodon of the methionine-carrying tRNA, which is the only kind that's allowed in. Then you have to spend some energy. We're used to spending energy in the form of ATP, but in this case it's GTP, which is very similar. It's just instead of having adenine as a nitrogenous base, it has guanine. So it's a guanosine triphosphate is what GTP is. It carries energy for the same reason. It has multiple phosphates on it. So you dephosphorylate GTP to use it. That turns it into GTP, and that provides the energy. For the rest of the initiation, which is for the large subunit to come along and join the party. And notice that it positions it so that the P slot is really where it is. I said that the A slot is used first, except for initiation. A, P, E will be the order over and over in the next part, which is elongation, but this is initiation. All right, now, this entire complex, meaning both subunits of the ribosome, the mRNA itself, the tRNA with the start code, the anticodon corresponding to the start codon, and methionine, the amino acid it's carrying, all of that collectively is called the translation initiation complex. Now we can go to elongation in 17. But we're looking at it already in progress. A little bit of it has already happened. Notice that four have already been added. And we're going to add the fifth one. But this is a cycle. Elongation is a cycle because it happens one turn of the cycle for each codon that gets read until you hit a stop codon. Once you hit a stop codon, you're no longer in elongation. Then you're in termination, which we'll look at next. But assuming that the A slot, which is where it's reading the next codon, is not a stop codon, then you have what's happening here happen. And we've already discussed the fact that whatever the codon is in the A slot is going to allow in only the kind of amino acyl tRNA with a corresponding anticodon, ensuring that the amino acid that it's carrying corresponds in the genetic code to the codon being read in the A slot. Okay, that happens. That's part of elongation. Then you have to spend some more energy in the form of GTP, and expenditure of that energy allows for the peptide that's currently connected to the peptidyl tRNA in the P slot, however long it is, that whole peptide as a unit gets transferred to the amino acid being carried by the amino acyl tRNA that just came into the A slot. That's the red arrow here. Okay, now it's 5 long, and that's why it should make sense to you that it requires some energy to do that, right? You're building a bigger thing, making it even bigger. That should always be endergonic, and in terms of metabolism, it would be anabolic, right? Okay, so then you get, once the transfer is made, at the moment, things are in their wrong slot according to their names, right? Because at the moment, this A slot tRNA is now a peptidyl tRNA, and the P slot tRNA is now an uncharged tRNA. But it's not going to stay that way, because when you spend some more GTP, that will cause the whole ribosome to shift by one codon with respect to the mRNA. And that means this uncharged tRNA that was in the P slot is now in the E slot, and it will be ejected. And the new peptidyl tRNA that was in the A slot is now in the P slot, where it should be, according to its what it is, right? That's one cycle. And that shift is also going to then open up a new codon being read in the A slot. And if it's not one of the 3 stop codons, then the same thing will happen, just bringing in different tRNAs and therefore different amino acids each time. Notice, though, that each turn, each single additional amino acid requires spending 2 more GTP. And polypeptides can be fairly short, dozens of amino acids. Some can be thousands of amino acids, which is expensive, right? You spend a GTP to start in initiation, and then 2 per what can be thousands of amino acids. And then, as we'll see, you also have to spend some in termination, which is in slide 18. Elongation continues as long as there are non-stop codons, but eventually you will reach a stop codon. And think back to the genetic code. The start codon, there's only one of, remember, is a double duty one, because it's not only a start codon, but it also specifies methionine, which is why it won't only be at the beginning. Whenever methionine is required at other positions other than the first position, you'll also be using that same codon and the same kind of tRNA. But the stop codons do not do double duty. There's 3 of them, and it doesn't matter which one you use, but all 3 of them specify no amino acid. And that's why when any one of these 3 stop codons comes up to the A slot, instead of a tRNA coming in, because there is no tRNA corresponding to any of the 3 stop codons, instead of a tRNA coming in, this yellow thing comes in, which is not RNA at all. It's a release factor. And a release factor, this is another use of the word factor to refer to a protein of some sort. A release factor is a special protein that actually recognizes a stop codon, and that's why it's allowed in instead of a tRNA. But it's not carrying any amino acid. And so basically that tells the ribosome the amino acid that you just got done adding was already the last one. And therefore the peptide, however long it is complete as far as translation is concerned. Don't add any more. That's what termination is. And so when that release factor comes in, this translation complex, combination of all these kinds of molecules that we've been talking about, dismantles. The now complete polypeptide in purple gets removed from the what was the peptidyl tRNA. Now it's an uncharged tRNA. The release factor comes off. The two ribosomal subunits come apart, and the messenger RNA detaches from the subunit, from the small subunit. But notice that requires expenditure of yet another tRNA. I mean, a couple more GTPs. Okay? So, it shouldn't surprise you that it's expensive to build a polypeptide. It's a large molecule. Now, importantly, I said that this complex dismantles, but the mRNA does not get dismantled. And, of course, neither does the polypeptide, which you just bothered to build. The polypeptide will, depending on its sequence, will fold up into three-dimensional shape that's appropriate for its function. The mRNA, though, is not dismantled. It just detaches from this ribosome. And that's important because as long as this messenger RNA exists, all of this can happen again with the same mRNA molecule. In other words, a cell does not translate a messenger RNA just once to make a single polypeptide. A single polypeptide is effectively never made. You always make many, maybe millions of polypeptides of identical copies when you need that job to be done. So a messenger RNA is reusable for as long as it exists. Now, it is appropriate to make many copies of a polypeptide, but not indefinitely. So there will come a time when you shouldn't be making any more of that polypeptide. And that's why messenger RNA molecules are never allowed to hang around forever. Eventually they do get degraded so that they can't allow for more proteins to be made when they shouldn't really be made. And that's if the next moment or sometime after the destruction of the mRNA, it becomes true that you need more of that protein, no problem, right? Even though you've destroyed that mRNA, you still have the gene. The library still exists. You never change that. So if you need the protein again, you no longer have the mRNA. You just go back to the original part of the process, which is transcription. Transcribe that same gene, you make an identical copy of that mRNA, and you can do it all over again. And by the way, just like an mRNA is used to make multiple copies of the polypeptide, when you transcribe a gene, you really don't make just one copy of mRNA. You can make many copies of mRNA, each of which can then make many copies of the protein. So you can ramp up production of proteins pretty quickly. Well, we can kind of see another way in which it's accelerated, this process of producing polypeptides. In 19, this is a complex structure. It's a single mRNA molecule, but that single mRNA has multiple ribosomes associated with it, each of which is translating that mRNA to produce the same polypeptide. All of these purple things are exact copies of each other, but they're at different points in their production. This single mRNA and the multiple ribosomes simultaneously translating it collectively are called a polyribosome. The point here is that not only are mRNAs reused, but you don't have to wait until a ribosome goes all the way down the length of an RNA to start the process again. As soon as one ribosome moves enough out of the way so that another one can clamp on and start translating its own copy, it will. And that's why you have polyribosomes. And polyribosomes can occur in either eukaryotic or prokaryotic cells. All right? Drastically speeds up production of the proteins. Let's look at 20 now. We're done with the process, the basics of translation, and therefore we're done with gene expression, but what about the fact that I said earlier that not all polypeptides really should have methionine in them as the final, in the final product, but they have to because the start codon specifies methionine. Well, that's just one example of why some polypeptides are not yet in their functional form right after they're built by translation. Translation is now done. I mean, we're pretending that translation is done. For some polypeptides, they are ready to go. They will naturally fold up into the right shape based on that sequence, and they'll start doing their job right there in the cytoplasm. But not all polypeptides are like that. Some polypeptides do not need, in other words, post-translational modification. Remember, we talked about post-transcriptional modification of mRNA, modifications to eukaryotic mRNA after transcription. Here we're talking about modification of polypeptides after they're built. That's post-translational modification. And only some polypeptides require that. So the question is, how does the cell know which ones need help and which ones don't? Well, when we first talked about ribosomes in the Tour of the Cell chapter, I used the phrases bound ribosomes and free ribosomes. Remember this? They're really the same exact ribosome, but in two different situations. So there isn't a structural difference. Free ribosomes, though, remember, are just ribosomes that are not attached to a membrane. They're just free in the cytosol. They're on their own in the cytosol. A bound ribosome is attached, at least while it's a bound ribosome, temporarily attached to a membrane. Well, all ribosomes are used for translation, for building polypeptides. And all polypeptides start out being built, in other words, translation, always starts out on a free ribosome, one that's not attached to a membrane. And then, once several amino acids have already been added, the polypeptide is not yet done, but you have some number of amino acids sticking off of this ribosome. Some of those amino acids that are the first to emerge can serve as a signal to the cell that I am one of these kinds of polypeptides that's going to need to be modified after translation, after I'm built. The ones that don't need help won't have that signal peptide, as it's called. It's just part of the polypeptide itself, but that sequence tells the cell I need help. All right? So that's how it knows. And of course, like all chemical signals, it's not going to do anything unless it's there's a receptor that receives it, right? In this case, the receptor is a protein, the orange thing, called a signal recognition particle, SRP. And it will bind to the signal peptide, which is just part of the still unfinished polypeptide. And when this SRP binds to the signal peptide, the whole translation complex, ribosome, mRNA, everything, gets moved to the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. Which I hope is not surprising to you, because the job, remember, of the endoplasmic reticulum, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, is to modify newly made polypeptides. Well, it's only going to do that for the ones that need modification, and that's what the signal peptide is all about. It tells the cell that it does need to be modified. And just like the nuclear envelope, the membrane of the rough ER has complexes of proteins forming little pores. And not only do they form that hollow tunnel, the pore itself, but the proteins making up the walls of the tunnel also have the right shape to bind to a corresponding shape on the signal recognition particle. That will allow this whole translation complex to dock to the pore in the membrane in exactly the right position, as you see here, for the still elongating polypeptide to be strung right through the tunnel and into the lumen, or the hollow interior, of the rough endoplasmic reticulum, which is exactly where a polypeptide that needs to be modified needs to go. Well, this is the same ribosome as it was when it started. That was a free ribosome to begin with, but once it docks, that now, by definition, makes it a bound ribosome. And that's what gives the rough ER its roughness in appearance. All those ribosomes that we saw in the photomicrograph, those were all temporarily docked. There'll be a whole new population of ribosomes later, and the ones that are docked at the moment will leave once the translation is done for those ones. But that's how it knows the difference between a polypeptide that does not need modification and one that does. If it does need modification, then once it's in the lumen, the ER will figure out what the modification needs to be, perform it, and then package it into a vesicle and send it along to the Golgi complex, like we've already discussed. 21. It's time to talk a little bit more about mutation. I've barely talked about mutation, but I've told you that a mutation is a change in DNA sequence for whatever reason. It can happen all kinds of different ways, including just purely by accident. For instance, there can be accidents that happen that don't get recognized in the DNA replication process. And if they don't get recognized, then the DNA is now different from what it was supposed to be. That's a mutation. But there are also all kinds of mutagens, which are just a name for things that can cause mutation to happen, like radiation, for instance, is a mutagen, or various chemicals are, and so on. That's what mutation is, a change in DNA sequence. And that can be a small-scale change or a large-scale change. We'll talk about larger-scale changes later in a different chapter. But these are very small-scale because these mutations that we're looking at are affecting just a single base pair, as it's called. A base pair is really just one nucleotide in length. It's a base pair because there's a nucleotide on one strand and there's a nucleotide in the same position on the other strand. So it's a pair of nucleotides, but in terms of sequence, it's one letter long. That's called a point mutation. A point mutation is a small, very small scale mutation. Well, in the left, we're looking at so-called wild-type hemoglobin DNA. Wild-type simply means it's the version, the sequence, that you find most often in the population. In this case, it's a population of humans. It could be whatever species. And we're not looking at the entire gene. First of all, hemoglobin, remember, is one of these multimeric proteins. It's made up of four overall polypeptides, but it's two copies of one and two copies of another. So really, it requires two genes, not just one. Each gene corresponds to a polypeptide. And we're only looking at one of those genes, and we're only looking at one triplet sequence of three nucleotides in the DNA. The rest of it we're not looking at because it's not going to be affected. But anyway, that's what wild type means. And in addition to all the other triplets, they get transcribed, but when this triplet gets transcribed, and it's not both of them, remember, in transcription only one of the strands of DNA is used. Which one is the template strand here, by the way? The top one, right. Because when you use a template strand, you produce mRNA that's complementary, right? CTT is complementary to GAA. So this GAA one in the DNA is ignored. It's the non-template strand. But anyway, when you transcribe the DNA and you get to this triplet, the CTT tells you, lay down a codon that's GAA, along with all the other codons. And if you do that, then you make so-called normal hemoglobin, which is a sequence of amino acids, of course, most of which aren't shown, but they're important. And the one that corresponds to the GAA codon is glutamic acid. Okay, it does a good job of carrying oxygen and CO2. Hemoglobin does. That's its main job. On the right, we have a mutant form of DNA from a mutant human that has sickle cell disease. This is what the mutation causes. But it's a point mutation, so almost the entire gene is correct. It's not even an entire triplet that's wrong. It's just one of the three nucleotides in the triplet that gets changed. That's why it's a point mutation. But it has that big effect, even though it's a small-scale mutation. So it's just this triplet that gets affected, and instead of CTT, it's now CAT for whatever reason. Well, the cell that's mutated, has DNA that's mutated, the cell doesn't know that it's mutated. It thinks it's the correct DNA. So it just normally transcribes it. It obeys that CAT sequence, and the corresponding codon in the mRNA is now going to be GUA instead of GAA. In other words, transcription happens perfectly. It's just obeying a different DNA code. But when you look up GAA in the genetic code, it specifies glutamic acid. When you look up GUA, it specifies valine instead. So all the other amino acids in this mutant hemoglobin are correct in the right order and the right amino acid. But this one is just one amino acid different. And therefore, it's going to fold up in three dimensions differently. Because remember, how it folds up depends on the sequence of amino acids and how they interact with each other when it folds. And that makes a big difference because not only does the hemoglobin not carry oxygen and CO2 well, which is what its job is, which is bad enough just by itself, but it also, because of the misshapen form, causes it to clump together with other hemoglobins. And that causes other problems. So that's a pretty stark example of how a mutation can have effect on the trait. Remember, it's the DNA does not give you your traits directly. Proteins give you your traits. It's the fact this is the protein. That's what's giving the sickle cell disease. But it happens indirectly because of the DNA being wrong. 22 is also about mutations. And these are point mutations, once again. So you have the wild-type DNA at the top, but there's two columns shown here because there's two categories of effects, or two categories of ways that point mutations can occur. On the left, we have what are called base pair substitutions. The word substitution is important here because in a substitution mutation, some nucleotide is there instead of what the nucleotide should have been there in the wild type. That's why it's a substitution. One is swapped for another. The reason that's important is that when you swap one nucleotide for another, that does not at all change the overall length of the sequence, right? You're just changing one letter in the sequence. All the others are in the right position and the right letters. So that means the effect of those mutations is going to be less pronounced than the ones in the right that I'll talk about in a minute. But there's multiple effects of substitutions. First of which is a silent mutation. Notice what's happening here. This is the triplet in the DNA that's affected. The wild type is CCG. In a sense, that's what it's supposed to be. The mutation makes it CCA instead. Well, that gets transcribed normally. And when you transcribe CCA, you make the mRNA codon GGU. It was supposed to be GGC. Well, GGC specifies glycine. That's the normal amino acid for that position. But because of redundancy of the genetic code, since 64 is more than 20, When you look up GGU, it also specifies glycine. And so even though this is a mutation, the DNA is different, you'll end up making exactly the right protein anyway. And that's why it's called a silent mutation. It has nothing to do with sound, it just means it's not noticed. It has no effect on the trait, because the trait depends on the protein, and the protein is the same. On the other hand, you can have what happened in sickle cell, which is to cause a different amino acid to be put down, and that's called a missense mutation. It's missense because it's kind of like getting one word wrong in a sentence. The rest of the words are still correct, but you mess up the sense of the sentence because you get one word wrong. Now, if a substitution can also happen to cause nonsense, though. The same thing is happening. You're changing the DNA, which has a corresponding change in the RNA. But what's happening here is that the A of this second triplet, I mean the T of TTC, gets changed into ATC. That corresponds to UAG in the DNA, I mean in the RNA, and that's one of the stop codons. So it turned a codon into a stop codon, which means now the cell thinks there aren't any more amino acids to add, and it stops, even though the polypeptide should be much longer. So it affected not just that one amino acid, but all the other ones after it. It didn't even add them. So that has a very little chance of working as a protein, right? It's not even big enough to do the job, let alone the right shape. In the right half, we have not substitutions, but either insertions or deletions. Either an insertion or a deletion is going to change the length of the overall DNA sequence, unlike substitution. An insertion means you're putting a nucleotide in between two others, but they're still there, so you make the sequence longer. Deletion is just the opposite. You take out a letter, and that's going to make it shorter in sequence. Well, making the DNA sequence longer or shorter is very drastic in its effect because it causes what's called a frame shift. When we were looking at the mRNA binding to the small subunit, it was important to center that start codon right in the slot, right? That sets the frame, the reading frame, as it's called. Now, think about our language made up of words. Codons are like words, and the mRNA is like a sentence. Unlike, well, in written English, it's easy to tell words apart from each other, right? Because we use spaces between them. There are no spaces between codons. And that's okay because, also unlike English, words are all three letters long. We have different lengths of words, but we use the spaces so we know where they begin and end. The codon doesn't have to worry about the spaces as long as it knows where to start, to set that frame. And then it will just say, okay, I count by threes, and each three is a new word. Well, if you change the length of the DNA by making it longer or shorter, you're going to change that frame. And that's why it's called a frame shift. Let's use an analogy with an English sentence, but you have to use a sentence that's made up of only three-letter words. So we could say the big cat ate the owl. Right, that sentence has a meaning. If we had an insertion mutation, that would be like, say, adding a P in here between I and G. Well, and that's going to now change the sentence into the BIPGCATATETHEOW, and then L, whatever. You see that? So the frame has been shifted, and that's going to make a completely different protein, because these are going to be, all of these amino acids are going to be different from what they're supposed to be. A frame shift caused by an insertion or a deletion mutation affects not only the codon that it occurs in, but all of the other codons after that. And therefore, there's very, very small chance that that's a survivable mutation. Notice that the same thing would happen if instead of adding one, I would take one out, but it would just be shifted in the other direction. And also, just think about how important the order of the amino acids are. It's not enough to just use the right kinds of amino acids. You have to make sure they're in a particular order, because that's the only way that they're going to have the right shape, which in sentence terms would be the same meaning. I mean, for instance, if you think of the six-word sentence, what on earth are you doing? That has a certain meaning, right? Well, I can use exactly the same six words, but in a different order, and say, what are you doing on earth? And that has an entirely different meaning, just like a different sequence of amino acids would have an entirely different shape, and therefore not work to do the same job. All right, 23. We've already talked about polyribosomes, which I said can occur in either a eukaryotic or a prokaryotic cell. But what we're seeing here is even more complex than that, and it can occur only in a prokaryotic cell. The reason it can occur only in a prokaryotic cell is because of what I've told you already, namely that since there's only one compartment, the mRNA that's produced in transcription in a prokaryote can be used for translation right away. So what we have here in blue is one gene, one DNA, that is simultaneously being transcribed at different places along its length by copies of RNA polymerase, each of which is producing one identical copy of the red mRNA. And not only is the mRNA ready to go right away in a prokaryote, but it doesn't even have to be completed yet. As soon as you get enough mRNA hanging off, even though it's not yet complete, as long as you have enough room for a ribosome to come along and clamp onto it, you can start translating it before transcription is even done. So this is several polyribosomes in different stages of development, so to speak, all connected to the same gene. And this can really ramp up production of a lot of copies of proteins in a prokaryote, which could be particularly important for a prokaryote to make these quickly, because, you know, if something goes wrong and you lose one cell, that's the entire organism. They have to be able to react quickly. No new information now. 24 is just a summary. But it's worth going through this, and you should be able to do this on your own without looking at anything as you study. We're looking at the process of gene expression in a eukaryote, of course, because there's a nucleus here. So that starts with transcription, which directly involves the DNA in a eukaryote that's in the nucleus, of course. And with the help of the special enzyme RNA polymerase, the two strands at the gene are separated, one of which is ignored, the non-template strand, one of which is read, the template strand. And by reading that template strand one nucleotide at a time and using the rules of strict complementarity, the RNA polymerase molecule knows which kind of RNA nucleotide to add one by one, forming what is called the RNA transcript. But since this is a eukaryotic cell, when that's complete, when transcription is complete, the mRNA is not yet ready to be translated. It has to undergo post-transcriptional modification in two major ways, one of which is to add the yellow ends, the 5' cap and the poly A tail, and also to use a spliceosome to recognize where the introns begin and end, splice them out, and then hook together all the exons to form the final mature mRNA, which is now able, because of those yellow ends, to get out of the nucleus through the nuclear pores into the cytoplasm, where it will meet up with a small ribosomal subunit, and then the big one will come along, and everything we just talked about today will happen, forming the ribosomal complex, the translation complex. And in the process of elongation, each shift along the length of the mRNA will reveal an additional codon, bringing the right kind of amino acyl tRNA in each time, carrying the appropriate kind of amino acid. Peptidal tRNAs transfer the peptide to the amino acid of the amino acyl tRNA, making the peptide longer by one amino acid at a time. Eventually, a stop codon will be reached, and that's a protein, not a tRNA, that comes in, the release factor, that is, and the thing dismantles, but this mRNA can still be used as long as it still exists, like I said. That is the unit, not just the chapter, that's the whole unit, which means next time is the test. Just don't forget to bring a Scantron, as usual.